Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be looking at Eldritch Wizardry, the third supplement to original D&D. And you know, it added druids, demons, psionics, artifacts, a bunch more to the game, and it's 50 years old this month. How much of it stood the test of time, and how much do we use today? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin today's conversation, I'll remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, Dan and I will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you will get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account set up over there during the course of the episode today, and maybe about 10 or 15 minutes after the end of the episode, Dan and I will be there to chat with you all.
We love that. We have the best patrons. For example, thanks to Backwiz for checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube in Restream. So we'll look forward to that. So Eldritch Wizardry, third supplement, 50 years. It was released in May of 1976 when I was only six at the time. Bicentennial of our country, right? I remember that. That's summer of 76. So it is 50 years old this month. And viewers, we had a debate about whether we should cover this. There was a rather significant debate in the background here about whether Paul and Dan should actually cover Eldritch Wizardry for a couple of reasons. An argument that one of us made was that it's interesting to see stuff that failed and why and what would we do differently as a result of that little bit of a scientific experiment. So
here's a little tangential background for you. So I have here sitting in front of me this book, this strange untitled brown book, which is my first test book. Actually, not really my first. I think the first one was the book I made for you, Dan. So some viewers may know there was a brief period of time where I was into bookbinding. And so I started collecting all of the PDFs of all of the little brown books and the supplements, et cetera, and binding them together into a solid book. There are exactly four such books in existence before I kind of lost the bug on this particular hobby. I made one for Dan. I think that was my first one. And I made this one as a test run for myself. And then I made two more that are exactly like this one, but with a fancier cover and titling and whatnot that went to Tim Kask and Frank Mentzer, who I was seeing pretty regularly at conventions at that period of my life. Dan, my version—I think I got none of them perfect. Is my analysis of this? Your version, I think, has starts with chainmail, right? It has chainmail, and then the three little brown books, and then maybe supplement one and two.
Yes, exactly.
Did I get two in there?
Just
yeah,
one.
And is that where it ends?
Just one.
Just one. Yeah. Just supplement one. Okay, yeah. So you have the perfect book. That's what I should have.
I do.
This book that I have does not have chainmail in it. Mistake. Number one. And then it does have all of the supplements. One, two, three, four, spells and wizardry, what is the name of that last one? Swords and spells.
Swords and spells.
Technically not get a supplement number, but you know, kind of there at the end. Here I've got my finger kind of in the thumb of like where I think it goes from being useful to not stop being useful. If I had to make this again, I would just take this whole section.
Yeah.
Rip it right off. why did I bother printing that and binding that? What a waste of paper. So I didn't really read these supplements, Dan, until I made the book, frankly. I like having a physical paper book in front of me. When I had them as PDFs, they just kind of sat on my computer. I didn't really look at them. So once I had the book, I was then like, okay, well, let's give these a read. Let's really like analyze and see what's going on and read some of these. And supplement one is really fascinating to me. I love, like, that is clearly the groundwork for what would become first edition AD&D. Mm-hmm. It is like the missing link, I think of it, between OD&D and AD&D. Supplement 2 has some ideas in it, if I'm kind. But as we all know, it's got an interesting history and how it came together and how it was edited and put together. And it's a bit of a mess, but there's some nuggets of gold hidden in there. And then it just continues to go downhill from there in my. And by supplement three, I just start paging through it and I'm like, why am I looking at this? Now here's a question I have for you. And kind of like, maybe you do or don't know the answer to this, but I tried to think of like, well, why? Why does this stuff exist? And I think this is still at a point when they haven't yet come up with the idea of publishing modules. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's a good point. Yes. So as they're looking to publish stuff, yes, they hadn't been convinced. Janelle Jaques was starting to put out some really interesting modules, and they weren't convinced that they should take that away from the DM's design effort. That would start the next year.
I find that fascinating, right? Because you see the very first inkling of that in supplement two, right? There's kind of an adventure hiding in there. And then they just don't do it, right? And I feel like that's probably the problem here, right? Is that they had a successful product and they were like, we need to make more. We need to make more content, but they don't want to make the content that clearly everyone wants. So instead they made this. that's where I think how we got here. That's my
reading the background. So Eldritch Wizardry has a bunch of design credits, right? That has a larger number of names on the credits page than the prior book. So there's a rather not huge, and Gary was integral to a lot of it, a larger number of sources where these ideas were coming from. And in me, you know, I had an opportunity to read some of the background about this particular book that's been written up by Shannon Appelkline. And there's a really nice blog by a guy named DM Dave that really kind of goes into depth on the psionics. And I'm convinced that they were responding partly to specific criticisms or desires from the player community. And it's kind of interesting to think about exactly where they felt that there was an outpouring of desire for some of these specific things. And so it's kind of interesting to think about where that was coming from, whether this was a good move or not, and what we potentially would have done differently. Now, one thing, of course, you mentioned Tim Kask, and we miss him terribly. We had him on the show once, wish we could have had him more often. So this is the second book that Tim Kask is the editor on, and he writes the foreword to it. And he was a lot, so with the prior book, he was largely just trying to rationalize, you know, make coherent Dave Arneson's notes from what we know. Kask was a lot more in-depth hands-on about the development of this book. And in fact, Steve Marsh, of course, he writes the foreword. Steve Marsh is on record as calling this the Tim Kask supplement.
Interesting.
Right?
Not aware of that.
Yes. In particular, he was super excited about psionics. And there was different sources, different ideas about where we could pull psionics from. There's a small number of fantasy novels that use the idea of psionics to like rationalize magic. And a couple different, like more than one input was coming from people that wanted to see psionics. Kask got really into it and supposedly spent a lot of time fine-tuning the psionic system, the combat. He said, I playtested it so much that my players got sick of it. And he was really involved in a lot of this particular psionics.
That is, gosh, now I feel so bad that he's not still around to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. Because Tim Kask used to come up here to Total Confusion, which is a convention that happens up here in Massachusetts. He used to come pretty regularly back in, a while ago. Let's just say a while ago. and that's the funny thing is, so I remember, like, I played in a bunch of his games, kind of got to know him a little bit, as much as you do for someone you see once a year at a convention. I remember specifically him being very salty about Blackmore, right? That's how I kind of know that backstory of that. I know it's well documented, but I specifically remember him talking to me about it at a convention and how salty he was about having to put that together. That said, we never discussed this supplement, but also I can say I never saw any psionics in any of the games he was running at TotalCon. Mm-hmm. So did he just like get it out of his system and then and then was like, yeah, maybe not? Or, you know, is it secretly the thing that he always loved and just like was like, I guess it didn't catch, so I won't keep pushing on it?
And, oh, I'm later, so curious. I believe in 2018, he went on record as saying it was too complicated in retrospect.
Interesting.
And I'd say good for him. Not everybody is going to reevaluate. Some folks would defend what had they had their name on to their death. And I'd say good, you know, good for Tim for reevaluating that, you know, in retrospect. But at one point he was super passionate about it. I mean, let's talk. Okay. So, maybe we should we, okay, let's talk about psionics. So we're on the psionics things.
Okay.
And you know, the book still is, they hadn't, it's still kind of scattershot. So it's, you need to jump all around the book to even find just the psionics information, frankly. So they were still working on how to lay out a book properly.
Yeah. It's so funny, right? Because you look at the index of this book and the top sections, right, have names like character alignment, determination of abilities, levels and numbers of experience points.
Yeah.
Right? They're clearly just trying to be like, oh, this is an addendum to this section that existed in the original set.
Exactly.
Is what they're trying to do. But what grabbed my eye there was like, oh, alignment or determination of abilities. Oh, they're new. They have a new system for how to roll your abilities in here. I'm like, no, it's mostly just about how psionics play. Like, oh, yeah. What? That's not what I was expecting.
Exactly. I totally agree. And I even this morning I was having trouble kind of piecing together all the pieces. So here's where psionics comes from. And again, it's not out of a void. So in the prior year, right, 1975, they started publishing their periodical, which was at the time called the Strategic Review. So this is pre-Dragon. Yep. They only made 7 issues over it of a couple of years. So the Strategic Review number 1, you know, which is TSR number 1, if you write down the abbreviation, right, had a single new monster, right? We're going to start making new monsters. And that monster was the Mind Flayer. Well, people love the Mind Flayer, right? It's flavorful, it's dangerous, it's extra dimensional, right? There's a lot of reasons why you love the Mind Flayer. It was given an ability called a psionic ability called a Mind Blast, which was a totally novel ability, and it had a big table and it affected your intelligence. And the thing is that ability, you know, was one of these like screw jobs of the players, is it cut through, it ignored your armor class. It ignores your hit points. The only thing that it does is it stuns you or charms you or drives you insane or flat out kills you based on your intelligence, right? And so there's no spell to defend against it. There's no armor to defend against it. It's just a complete screw job to the players. So they're at a point where they're completely committed to never changing anything that had been published previously. So the only response they have to something that in the game is, we'll add more content to defend against that, right? And so the instinct at the time is, well, now we our only response to that, if players are putting out a hue and outcry over how unfair this is and how fearful Mind Flayers are, is we need to give psionics to player characters. And we specifically need to provide them with defense. And they can get Mind Blast, and that makes it fair. And they can get defenses against the Mind Blast, right? So that's so this was such an obvious to them desire that 2 different people started working on this. And Gary Gygax was making a new class called the Divine Class that did it one way. And Steve Marsh made a completely other class called the Mystic that did it a totally different way. And so both of these things came to Cask. Cask got really excited. He synthesized them. And that's why there's actually these 2 totally different categories of capacities. The whole psionic attack defense mode combat matrix, well, that was Gygax's approach. And the whole abilities that act like spells, that was Steve Marsh's approach. And that's why you have these like 2 different lobes of the psionics. And Cask developed it. He spent a lot of time on those combat matrices. He playtested. There's a whole bunch of psionic-only monsters in this book because Cask felt you needed that to balance it. Use psionics, you get attacked by a brain mole or an intellect devourer or another thing or another thing or another thing. And it was all, so it was ultimately motivated by how do we defend ourselves against this horrible Mind Flayer. And more than one person was coming up with responses to that.
Mm-hmm. Dandy, I almost wonder if the Mind Flayer deserves its own episode or not, but just real quick, do you use the Mind Flayer in your own games?
I do. I do put Mind Flayers, yep. You know, particularly Underdark stuff. I have the little table for the Mind Blasts in my book. I have it in my arena program to balance how dangerous it is. It is very dangerous for all those reasons. So I have to have a little bit of code specifically to handle the Mind Blast. So I'm totally ready to throw Mind Flayers at people.
Fascinating. Yeah.
As unfair as it is.
It's a content that has never been sticky with me. Okay. You know, the funny thing is, I played a lot of Baldur's Gate 3. Wonderful game. I really enjoyed that game a bunch recently. I will admit, when I first bought that game and I loaded it up, you know, the opening sequence is you are trapped by a bunch of Mind Flayers in a kind of Spelljammer-esque ship, right? Mm-hmm. And it's crashing. That's the opening gambit. Like, you wake up in a, you know, in a prison, essentially, of a Mind Flayer Spelljammery ship. And I rolled my eyes and I turned the game off and I didn't play it for months. Why would they do this? Was my initial reaction.
Oh no.
I eventually gritted my teeth because I just heard so many good things about the game. I was like, I'll just push through this content, I guess, and hope that it doesn't, you know, constantly beat me over the head with it.
But we have to admit that it's exciting to a lot of other people in the universe, right? So there's a lot of modules with Mind Flayers, and there's a lot of like Mind Flayer variants and the brain and the leader and the spawn and the this and the that, and there's Spelljammer stuff and Underdark stuff, and even in the Ravenloft campaign, right? They've got a Mind Flayer, you know, leader of a domain.
It's a weird creepy monster. I kind of wish that flavor of like we need a whole set of other rules for it and just never came about, right? Like just make it a creepy weird alien thing that we don't really understand, because that's what's exciting about the Mind Flayer, I think, is that it is creepy and weird and we don't understand it, right?
I actually don't mind that we have a mechanic to reflect that it's so creepy and weird in other places that there's a mechanic that doesn't actually fit in our system. Now, for me, that's one of these things that I'm fundamentally, properly balanced. I'm comfortable with that being on the DM side of the screen with a monster, but I'm not comfortable with a thesis that anything that happens in the game has to be available to player characters. Because once we do that, once you provide it to the player characters, it's immediately no longer exotic and mysterious and extra dimensional. Now it's just a series of mechanics. So I do think that I don't mind having the game, but I don't think it's a good idea to give it to players.
I think that's a great point, frankly, because I feel like I had the exact same reaction when I sat down back in like 2018 at an event that Wizards of the Coast was hosting, where they were announcing their whole like Avernus expansion, right? All this Avernus content was coming out.
Devils and hell.
You're going to go to hell and blah, blah, blah. Right. Frankly, also present in Baldur's Gate 3. And again, another case where I'm like, can't devils and demons just be creepy and weird and from another planet or another plane of existence and we don't understand them? And that's enough. That is enough. For me, I don't need the whole thing to be mechanized and then for it to become just like, we're going to go to hell. Let's everybody get in their, you know, special magic hell transport and prepare to deal with all the hell content that is unique and bespoke to being in, not even hell, right? We've got to call it Avernus.
Learning.
I guess I agree with your basic premise there of like, keep this stuff on the DM side of the screen. It doesn't need it doesn't need all this extra crap just so that the players can engage with it.
Yeah. Now let me pitch two other things about the psionic system. Is that at the time, so here we are 2 years in D&D, and there's among the criticisms, there's two very common criticisms that some people will still pitch today. Number one is that people don't like classes. It's like people will say, well, the world doesn't run on classes. I can learn any discipline or book that I want. I should have more flexibility. Well, psionics give you some flexibility. Any character class fighter, magic user, cleric, thief, any character class can potentially, now you only have at best a 10% chance of this happening, but any character class can add on psionics, and you can have a different variety of abilities from character to character. And now you have your class breaking flexibility, perhaps. And two, people don't like Vancian spell memorization. They say we should have had a system based on points, where we have a certain number of strength, magic strength points, and you can pump that into any ability you want to use. Well, that's exactly how psionics work. You have a psionic strength score that's basically, that starts off as a percentile roll with a whole bunch of modifiers, and whatever ability you have, you can power that, or your attack defense mode, with these points, and now you have a point-based magic-like system. So this is what you want, players, right? This is what you want. But of course, I agree that having multiple mechanical systems in the same game is, you know, too many multitudes of stuff. And I don't think that it occurred to them that there is a point where just adding more and more and more stuff is not a great idea. You do need kind of have a stable design spine to how this is, you know, the idea of a core mechanic just hadn't been invented yet. Those words were not in the world yet.
Yeah. It's funny. It's funny to me how much this has come, like, I'm realizing now how much here is flavored by stuff that I also saw and got to play with in Baldur's Gate 3. So I apologize if I keep bringing that up. But there's a whole mechanic in that about how your character finds these weird parasites, which they can voluntarily, like, shove up their nose to go up into their brain and unlock certain psionic abilities. And you're consistently told, like, this is super dangerous. Are you sure you want to do this? You're corrupting yourself. But the downsides are purely that, right? They're never, as far as I saw, never any mechanical disadvantage to doing it. It's just, like, the story text telling you, like, maybe you don't want to do this. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then the abilities it unlocks, I end up not really using them, frankly, to be honest. I usually have other abilities that are more interesting to use for that character. So I'm like, why? You're like trying to give me this carrot and tell me it's amazing, but also it's not that amazing. And also you're telling me that it's bad, that I'm doing it, I'm corrupting myself. Why is this here? That's what I kept coming back to in the game. Like, why am I wasting my time engaging with this bit of content? It's so odd. It just feels so out of place.
Yeah, I hear you.
Weird.
Now, we shouldn't spend the whole hour here just talking about psionics. Let's talk briefly. Let's talk about druids, right? So this is the new player class. I mean, I suppose you could say, should the psionics have been its own class, which Cask decided against. But the new class here is druids. Druids previously showed up in the first supplement in Greyhawk as a monster, right? As a monster-only NPC class. They had to be neutral. Monsters only, maybe they're doing human sacrifice, I don't know. And again, the outcry was, well, why can't we players have this, right? Here's a class. We don't like it being NPC only. It should be available to us players. And secondly, right, we've now have the precedent that new classes are a thing. We put out the thief class in supplement one. We've got the monk class in supplement two. So people are thinking about what other classes can we make. Obviously, the druids in the game is an NPC. We should have this. So the druid as a player character class was initiated by Dennis Sestere. And he is listed in the credits as the Great Druid on the credits page. Later on, I believe Cask made a spell for him called Chariot of Sestere, which is a high-level transport spell later on. It's a subclass of clerics. Like the monk, it has a top level limit. You can't get past 13th level. There's only one, and you have the limited number, right? There's only one of the top level great druid. There's three of the one beneath that. You have to duel in order to advance a level. Apparently, there's actually a comment by Julius Caesar in his war against Gaul that reports on this, that there's only one great druid, and when he dies, there's an election or maybe a combat. And so this is directly from historical reports by Julius Caesar that the druids work this way, which is kind of interesting. You get a custom spell list, but half the spells refer back to stuff that already exists.
And I mean, we did an entire episode on Druids. So, you know, folks want to see hear us deep dive on Druids. There's a whole episode on it. Go check it out. It's funny that you're mentioning like this addition of classes. I feel like this is something that we see TSR struggle with over and over again, right? And I immediately think to second edition when you start to see all of the splat books, kits come into play, right? Now we got to add kits that are extra things you can, you know, further new, basically things you bolt onto your class. And then races, right? We see this happen with races too. You get stuff like, now the drow are super popular thanks to Bob's book. So, like, now let's write a whole book on how you can play drow. Fascinating.
And anything that's rare and exotic and unattainable becomes desirable, and then it gets sucked into, and you get this constant treadmill of like, well, now that's not rare and exotic anymore. Like, we can see how it works. We need to find a new, thing that's just barely out of reach. Now, Paul, you and I have a fair, we don't add new classes willy-nilly to our games. We actually have, I should just speak for myself, I keep a fairly strict minimal number of things, namely three. I've got fighters, I've got wizards, I got thieves. That is it. I do permit some flexibility with like my fighter thieves that I kind of stole from the third edition idea. I know that some of our viewers don't feel the same way. Some of our viewers tell us regularly in the after chat that, like, if I have players come to my table and go, I really want to play a leprechaun, I don't know, whatever, I want to play a magical pony, I want to play a magical rainbow pony, right? I provide a way to make that happen. I twist some mechanics a little bit, I make sure it's balanced, I let the player use the new thing. If we had a player come to our games, Paul, and said, I really, really, really want to play a druid. What's our best response to that desire?
I mean, I feel like what we both do, now keep in mind, and this, you know, this is coming from a place of having experimented with this a bit, right? When I first came back to old school D&D, I was running BX, right? So you have classes, you have races class in there, you have seven classes for the different non-human types in addition to the human types. And one of the first things I added to that was paladins and rangers. I remember we were using Labyrinth Lord, and I looked up, I think Brave Halfling did some supplements to add paladins and rangers, which I really liked, not just because they feel very traditional D&D to me, but because it came up in the campaign that these organizations existed in the world that we were developing, right? So there was a brotherhood of holy knights that are effectively paladins. There was a strange underground network of outdoorsmen that was the rangers. So I like those existing. And so the funny thing is, as much as I say, like, yeah, I don't want to willy-nilly add races and classes and just, you know, blow it out the door, I also don't mind folding it in when it is a natural extension of what's happened in the campaign. Right. And I think you've said this too, right? I'm okay with adding stuff to the game or giving players stuff that is normally out of the reach of players if it's tied into the action of play. Right. If you want to go discover a path to learn to use your mental powers, and that's the whole thrust of the campaign. You know, I had a whole campaign where people were trying to figure out how to restore lost limbs. Right. And so that the whole concept of regeneration and limb growth became part of my campaign. So I'm down with that. Likewise, in these cases, right, if somebody came if I was starting up a new D&D campaign, they were like, super want to play a druid, I would say, great. Start with, I don't know, a magic user, I guess, and druid them up, right? Like, pick spells appropriate to that, right? Like, and then maybe we'll add some spells. Maybe I'll have you, like, invent spells in the game that make sense to being a druid.
Exactly what I was going to say. And maybe I would look at this supplement for some inspiration about what spells might be interesting ideas that I hadn't thought of, frankly. Wouldn't drop it in willy-nilly, but that's exactly what I would have said, Paul, is start off with a wizard. Maybe use some multi-classing if a thief sneaky thing is helpful or you want more weapons. And I would start providing some spells in the campaign that you could go hunt or research or dig up or unearth.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that's very interesting, right? Like, Yeah.
And easier to balance. Frankly, easier to balance like one element at a time rather than a whole class from start to finish.
And the other weird thing about druids, though, is it borders into the realm of, you know, the fact that in OED, you've completely removed clerics, right? And part of that is removing religious overtones from the game. And certainly druids are putting them back in, right? It's not Christianity, it's a different religion, but it's still religion, right? We're still chucking religion in there.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
A little odd. It's interesting that you mentioned that they were monsters first. Can you think of, are there like any early content where they show up? Any interesting modules where druids are the bad guys?
Well, this whole thing is pre-modules, right? So
That's bad. I'm so curious about how they ended up in there. When, you know, I would love to see an adventure where you have to go up against the evil druids.
Well, the neutral.
I guess
druids.
They're not evil though. They're neutral. They're neutral. Okay. Yeah. How were they being used? I'm so curious how they were being used.
Well, I mean, there's an interesting little line. Again, it's so sketchy, but there's an interesting line in this book of like they're dedicated to protecting woodland plants and animals. Okay, but they won't sacrifice themselves. They won't get in front of an attack and die themselves. What they will do is they will take revenge later. So maybe that's a tiny little difference between lawful, you put your own body on the line, neutral, I'll get you later, which is an interesting little, I might not remember that another day, but that's kind of an interesting little way to define the difference.
You know, so another interesting place where I came up on sort of the oddity of druids is in my quest campaign. I'm still running a quest campaign. If you look at the quest game, it has roles instead of classes, but there's a very obvious mapping of quest roles back to D&D classes. But they've also scrubbed the religious element out of it. So you do have rangers. Rangers are there. And then instead of druids, you have the naturalist, which is a outdoorsy person who has the ability to turn into animals and et cetera, right? So it's clearly a druid. And once you scrub the religious nature out of it, like the line between ranger and druid gets real thin.
Yes.
And I've had to try and like really analyze it and be like, well, what is the difference? And really what I came down with is simply this, that rangers live in the forest and druids are of the forest.
Interesting.
Basically kind of where I came through, right? Like rangers still have a connection, albeit thin, to civilization, right? They're there to protect mankind, protect civilization against the wilds, and to help them, you know, whatever, deal with the creatures that live in the wild. Where the druids probably want to overthrow civilization. They probably like actually would prefer the forest to win, right?
Nice.
Like, yeah, nice. you should. It's a beat 'em versus join 'em kind of attitude difference, I think, between the rangers.
Nice. We're currently playing Quest for a couple sessions in our Friday games, actually. And I in the past I have played a ranger myself in Quest, but apparently I tend to play more wizards there than other things. Let's talk about so new monsters. Okay, so this is the book where demons. So now on the one hand you get the psionic monsters, right? There's a whole roster of psionic monsters, mostly by Cask, that I've never used, I'll confess. Because they're just there to balance against player characters overusing their psionics. Let's not worry about that. But this is the book that introduces demons for the first time. Not devils, not everything. It has the classic roster of type 1, type 2, type 3, type 4, type 5, type 6 demons. And also the succubus, right? And this is mostly designed by Gygax, the whole sequence. I think there's some medieval texts that actually suggest the same typing system, actually, is where this comes from. You got demons' amulets. All the demons have psionics, because that's integral to this book, as a little side point, right? To counterbalance them, there's a couple of good or divine monsters, the Coatl, the Chiron, Shidu, which are all, you know, actual real world mythology. And at the top of the chain, you have the unique bosses. You have Orcus and you have Demogorgon for the first time. And, you know, clearly these are intended to be top level, top your campaign bosses. Your player characters have cut through every other monster we have in the book. So you need something bigger to contend with them, to challenge them maybe near the end of the campaign. And you get a full page illustration of Demogorgon for the first time. You get a page of statistics for Orcus, his wand, right? The wand of Orcus artifact is in here. And so probably, you know, Paul's next question is going to be, have we ever run Orcus or Demogorgon in our games? And I'm pretty sure the answer for both of us is no. But again, they're enormously popular IP in later years. It's the logo to Necromancer Games uses Orcus. There's TSR modules that have Orcus. Demogorgon is a whole campaign, a whole season of Stranger Things, you know, on a, you know, very, you know, a morphized version of Demogorgon. But here's the thing that I note. This is, to my awareness, this is the first time that any monster got an individual name. You look through all the prior rules and books. No, even like you look at the early modules, like early modules by Gygax, module B2. Nobody in the keep has a name. It's just like, here's the priest, here's the castellan, here's the merchant, here's the banker. They hadn't come up with the idea of people have names. And so I do kind of embrace the idea that we have, at the end of our campaign, a powerful, unique, individual, intelligent, recognizable, named enemy to contend with. And I also don't mind that it's something that like is shared among D&D players, and we kind of all know who that is if you threaten to have Orcus come on the table. So so even without using these specific statistics or something like that, it's an interesting novel idea that that's even a thing you might want to develop in your game.
Interesting. I do like demons in my games. I do use them.
I do
enjoy that. However, like I like them as big, powerful. Like this is real bad. Once demons are involved, oh no, right? Like, and usually it's you know, some wizard meddling in things that they shouldn't meddle in, and sure enough, a demon has showed up. I very much like that theme. Usually they're so bad. What I really want is I almost want more uniqueness. I want to lean into that. Like Orcus is Orcus, right? I want them all to be like that. And the funny thing I find about this grouping of demons here is we somehow subvert that when you start naming them things like type 1, type 2, type 3, right? Like I want it to be like, I, you know, am Azaliyal, the demon lord of the ninth gate, and I'm unique because I have a dog head and bat wings and six legs, right? Like something, right? And I just want every one of them to be unique and horrifying and terrible. So like the one thing that makes me cringe a little bit about this content is really type 1, type 2, really? Oh, it's a common type 1 demon. Nothing to worry about, friends.
I'm okay with both. I think we can, that one, I think we can live with both. My understanding is this is directly from some medieval literature where some monk was trying to delineate the different categories. I don't mind having categories that are kind of like your hordes of hell, potentially, like your armies of these horrible things. But your motivation, entirely understandable. Again, I think that was kind of a fairly common desire. I think it's the strategic review number 2 that does exactly that. It says you want your demons to all be unique. Here's a bunch of tables you can use that suggest powers and form and things like that. Then you can totally use this for your unique demons. And then that got into the AD&D DM's guide. There's an appendix specifically for that. Now, it takes a little bit of time, right? It takes a little bit of time to craft your unique demon, so I don't mind having a stock thing that I can pull out with zero prep, but that's supported, and I think a great idea, frankly.
Yeah, I almost think Warhammer does this better with not just with their demons, but with, like, mutants, right? Your entry point to demons is usually mutants, and mutants are people who have gotten involved with the powers of chaos and the magic has seeped into them and mutated them in some horrible way, and they're outcasts and terrible and horrible. And yes, you can go look in the book of, like, here is the stats for a mutant, and the first thing you're going to see in there is roll on this chart for what mutation they have. And that's what I want, right? I want, like, this is a demon from the first level of hell. Roll on this chart 3 or 5 or 7 times for the crazy things about this particular instance of that particular demon.
Got it.
I like that, right? I don't want hordes upon hordes of identical-looking, giant-beaked, long-limbed creatures, right? I want them all to just be a little different from each other, all just horrible in their own unique, terrible ways.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out, maybe one of our viewers can remind me which strategic review has that series of tables that does that for original D&D, because wait the second, I can't put my finger on it. But legitimate, a lot of people would agree with that. And I just can't.
I get what you're saying about, like, the historical context of the type names, but just, man, immediately seeing that title just turns me off and I flip the page. Nope, I don't want. I know, and I've never used any of the type demons. I might have stolen some of ideas from them. Ooh, I like this power. I like this appearance. I like this physical trait of this demon. I have never used any of the type demons in any of my games.
Now, they appear in a number of classic modules. So particularly when you do the D series against the Drow, right? They're demonologists. Yep. There's quite a number of demons running around in the encounter tables and some of the encounters. So I have run them because of that. I have multiple miniatures, right? I think I have Reaper made miniatures for a number of those standard typed demons. You know, at least one or two of the names come out of the why am I blanking on the Italian Trip Through Hell novel. This is really embarrassing. I'm totally blanking on. I'll think about this in about 2 minutes.
I'm not sure exactly what you're thinking of. Yeah, okay.
Anyway, my point is I have used these a couple times. And I think as a starting point, I don't mind a drag and drop, just a whole thing made that I can just grab onto right the second, and then we can make more elaborate stuff as a set. Dante's Inferno, thank you so much.
Of course. Okay.
So at least one of the Glabrizu or something is something that shows up in Dante's Inferno tier 6 or something like that. So I don't mind having starting with something relatively simple I can grab, and then we can make more elaborate, unique stuff later. And of course you want that. It's a great idea. Yep. Absolutely.
I will also say, I also like, again, I'll jump to Warhammer here. I think Warhammer just did a better job generally on demons. In D&D, you have, in this edition, do we have demons versus devils here in Eldritch Wizardry?
You don't. Devils, right? And partly, we still just have a 3-point alignment system, really. Law, neutral, chaos. So demons fit your chaos supernatural stuff. The Chiron, Coadal meet your lawful stuff. And you don't get devils until AD&D.
Yeah, and I like Warhammer kind of stuck with that. You just have demons, and demons come from chaos magic, and chaos magic is its whole thing. Like, it just, when I think of demons as they appear in Warhammer, I see no religious overtones at all, right? This is a weirdly, uniquely Warhammer thing. Whereas when I read the demon entries in D&D, I'm like, I'm seeing the historic lines back into, this is about Christianity, is what this is about.
I hear. There's two other things in the book that I really want to address before we run out of time. One is they have a big section on detailed artifacts and relics. And they do, you might want to, I have an image for all this stuff. You might want to pull up the image that has the artifact on it. It has a blue dot. It has a couple things there.
You'll have to give me a minute on this one, Dan. I unfortunately did not set this up at all.
Okay, if that's a problem, don't worry about it. I just wanted to look at a little thing that they lay out there. So as Paul's pulling this up, right, this is the first time, again, like things that are named that became really important later in D&D history, this is where the first time you get the Mace of St. Cuthbert, you get St. Cuthbert appearing. You get the Hand of Vecna, right? Well, again, Vecna is the ultimate villain, again, in Stranger Things, and there's all kinds of books and novels and adventures that build on, you know, Vecna, his traitor henchman, Cass, the Sword of Cass is here, Baba Yaga's hut. I know that at least one of our viewers has recently been making a Baba Yaga's hut miniature poem. the Ring of Gax, the Mighty Servant of Luko, that was a item that was possessed by Luke Gygax's character, right? So a whole bunch of these names that became really important imaginative touchstones to D&D. And here you've got the page that has the, and Vecna is an allusion to Jack Vance, right? It's actually, it's an homage by Gygax to Jack Vance, who gave us so much. And that's still paying, that vein is still paying thresholds today. So here you've got the page that I just grabbed two. You've got the Iron Flask of Tourney the Merciless. You've got Queen Alyssa's Marvelous Nightingale, which apparently was inspired by one of, I think, Gygax's aunts had like an antique bird in her house, and that inspired this thing. At the bottom, I think you might have Queen Alyssa in combat with Orcus, for what it's worth. And if you look really closely at the bottom of these entries, right, a couple pages later, you have these big tables, and some of us will be familiar with the same kind of thing in the AD&D DM's Guide. They have these tables of powers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up through 50. And like with the bottom of Queen and Alyssa's Marvelous Nightingale here, you see on the left, it says suggested powers from table 1 are maybe 1K and 1W. And you can go look those up. And from table 2, we suggest that this has power, I think, B and D. But over on the right of the page, there's a little blank spot that's labeled actual powers. And so the idea here is that let me read something from Tim Kask's foreword, because he's got a whole paragraph just on the motivation for this. Okay, so the third paragraph in Kask's foreword is, the new concept pioneered within these pages should go a long way towards putting back in some of the mystery, uncertainty, and danger that make D&D the unparalleled challenge it was meant to be. Legend lore once again becomes the invaluable spell it was meant to be. No more will some foolhardy adventurer run down to a dungeon, find something, immediately know how it works, and even what it does. By the same token, no longer will you be able to send your unfortunate hirelings to their demise experimenting with the goodies. So they're really worried here about the fact that all the players have bought all of our books, and they've read all the powers of the spells and all the powers of the monsters and magic items. This is a big problem for how Gygax and Kask expected the game to be run. They didn't expect the players to have the rules available. And the fact that everybody has it, like the prior paragraph actually says, this is great for our company, but it's terrible for our game. The players should not have the rules. So what they've done specifically for the artifacts is the system of like, well, could have these abilities, but DM, we recommend that you pick other ones. For your specific campaign, we want you to have a roster that your players can't look up and don't know and get surprised by. And, you know, when you go to AD&D, same kind of idea, but they ripped out the suggested powers. There's only, in AD&D, you must fill in the blanks as the DM. They don't give you any starting ideas. So if you did play first edition AD&D and you ever wondered what the real power is supposed to be, you got to come back to original D&D, Eldritch Wizardry, and you'll see what they intended the actual powers to be for all the artifacts. What an interesting problem I don't think we would think of today, and what an interesting attempt at a stab at a solution for your top end magic items.
It's good for them for identifying that this is a problem. That's what I gotta say. Good for them. Yes, I feel like the solution is ham-fisted, but yes, like I want the mystery back. I want, you know, strange, yeah, unique items. Again, like there is something just, I don't know, I mean, there's almost maybe, I guess, a little paradox at play here in that I do like that there are certain artifacts that are just so recognizable. You talk, if in casual conversation, right, with other D&D players, you say something about like the Hand and Eye of Vecna, and they immediately know what you're talking about. That is interesting, right, and cool, right? I think, right, that is fun. That said, I also do want unique, interesting magic items with backstory and history and unique powers and etc. in my campaigns. 100%, very much want that. I remember as a young person trying to incorporate some of this stuff into my campaigns, especially the ones where you had to collect the pieces. You know, the Rod of Seven Parts,
the
Hand and Eye of Vecna, right?
Yep.
Like those kinds of things. Like that seemed super cool to me. I'd say it never came together, right? I was always trying to make them so grandiose and interesting and exciting, these big lofty goals for my players that we just weren't playing frequently enough or whatever for it to ever actually materialize.
Yeah. I see that. Right? Yeah.
I get that. So I almost think that, like, again, maybe the problem here is simply that they're making content for the players that they're playing with, which are people who are playing the game constantly all the time and have been for years and are saturated in it. And like my players, this is too lofty for my game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do love the idea of unique items, and I try to imbue that into my games as much as possible. In fact, again, I'll go back to the quest campaign. That happens now all the time in my quest campaign because there are no such things as like standard +1/+2 weapons or whatnot. Every magic item they find is unique and interesting and bespoke. And I love that. I want that. I don't think this is quite the way to achieve that, right? I want something more like maybe Matt Finch's Tome of Adventure design kind of approach of like, give me crazy tables of words to combine and powers and whatnot and let me invent the history behind it, right? Here you have like, here's this very interesting history behind an item, and then we're just going to random shuffle the powers. Like, now the powers are just totally disconnected from the backstory. That's weird.
Choosing, right? DM, there's no rolling, right? There's no tables to roll on. Yeah. The DM has to select.
I still think it's a poor solution. I respect the problem they were trying to solve, and I don't think they succeeded at all.
I might use. I haven't, but I would not be. I would not have a problem with using this. I like having some recognizable community familiar names and stuff. So if the Wand of Orcus comes from another dimension and drops into my world, right, or the Hand of Vecna, I might actually be willing to do that. People will recognize it. I kind of like having a bit of a common community subconscious, I guess. And then, like, what does it do in our world? Well, that we don't know. That we're going to have to find out because that's a mystery, and there's no way to look that up. So I would potentially actually use, you know, maybe Orcus or one of these recognizable artifacts in addition to custom stuff that was in my world. Hmm. I don't think it's a terrible idea.
Well, we just will have to disagree on that one. I would not use any of this.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. That's fine. I wouldn't base everything on this. It wouldn't be the only stuff in my world, but I don't mind having some familiarity some common touchstones to the D&D community that we recognize is I think is a strength, honestly.
I would probably only bring it in if I had like a player who's playing a wizard who's getting up in levels and they start talking about like, I want to contact Orcus. I'm going to try and pull one over on Orcus. Okay. I'm like, all right, well, now Orcus exists. Now the Wand of Orcus is a thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Love it.
But I wouldn't put it in myself.
Okay. That's fine. That's fine.
There's else one other thing in the book. Time here.
Yeah, I totally know. And so on, if you can pull up an image that's got the purple dot on it. So, and this is early in the book, right? So I skipped over what to me, my mechanical Asperger's-y mind thinks is one of the most interesting things that absolutely didn't get into any later games, is that there's an extended piece of giving more detailed combat, which splits your standard combat round up into smaller little snippets that they're going to call segments. And it's entirely disconnected from initiative rolls. Remember that in original D&D, in the original book, there was no mention of initiative, right? There was a big blank spot about what to do. So maybe you go back to chainmail. Well, chainmail actually has two different mechanisms. These guys are coming out of a war game environment. They're very familiar with games that have simultaneous movement. So they have like a five-page section here where they say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to chop the combat roundup into six segments. You're going to take your dexterity, you're going to apply this rather large number of adjustments on the top of the page here based on armor, surprise, what rank in the group you're in, are you encumbered, how much wounds do you have, what level of spell do you have. That's all going to modify your dexterity. You're going to look up on the table in the prior page whether you can shoot or cast on segment number 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7, actually, right? And then having discovered that, you got to count what the elapsed duration is. And if I cast on segment 5, I got to count 5 segments into round 2, which I think would put me on 5 and 10 mod, 6 would 4. So I think next time you're going to cast on segment 4. And then in addition to that, the bottom of the page here, you're going to move a little bit every segment. So if I have a 3-inch movement, you can see down here, I can move half of an inch per segment. And everybody's movement becomes simultaneous. You can apply melee blows when you actually contact each other. The bottom of this table goes on for the next page. And then maybe you go 3/4 of an inch in a segment, or maybe you go 2 inches or something like that. Every inch represents 2 feet. On the board is the suggested scale here. And so very, very super high detailed, basically trying to get at simultaneous movement. And this is, of course, in response to, I mean, we'll still have debates about this today of, I don't like the fact that on my, like the opponent wins initiative, they can run all the way across the room and hit me. Couldn't I cast a spell? Couldn't I shoot a missile? Couldn't I put my spear out? Right? We still debate how to properly handle that today. And they put this super, and this was supposedly Gygax and Kask developing this, thought it might be a good idea. And this is something that absolutely was terminated, right? This died a hard, dusty death. It's not in AD&D. And
is this fact, not Gygax, the, wait. Is this not the origin of weapon speeds? That's what came into my brain as you were describing this.
AD&D
has segments, right? AD&D has segments. That idea
it does use differently. Right, use in an entirely different manner. This segment by segment movement does not exist. The combat by dexterity, right, is not in there. Gygax specifically has the start of the combat section. The DM's guide says we are not going to have a complicated second based combat system. It's too complicated. We're not using dexterity to determine who goes first. That's just reflected in your improved AC value. That's all we're going to do now. And he goes on kind of at length, diatribing against. That this is too complicated. Arneson's system for hit location tables are too complicated in Supplement 2. So these big additional details in Supplement 2.3, he specifically flipped on, argues against, and was basically aborted. And again, you know, here's a thing where I think another problem they were having is that Gygax was in a state of, other people are passionate. I think this is a bad idea. Right, I think weapon speeds, and I think that weapon adjustments is fundamentally a bad. I think psionics is not a great idea. He didn't like psionics, but if someone else is passionate about it, he was like, great, it's additional content. Right, if somebody else wants it, it gets in the book, and we weren't at a point
again, that,
where
like my gut says that's like a well, we gotta put pages in here somehow. We gotta sell paper in some way.
I think there's a dark trinity of design habits they had. Number one was, we don't change anything that came before, right? So if mind flayers are broken, we're not going to fix it. We're just going to add more stuff. Two, anybody that's passionate, even if I, the lead designer, think it's a bad idea, I want them to be involved, and I want their input to the game. And three, yeah, there's a more pages, more stuff we can sell. And those three things together kind of make this almost cancerous, like just more and more and more and more stuff, even if it doesn't fundamentally make sense, and even if the lead designer doesn't even like it. And I think those three things together caused a lot of problems. And it's interesting that he at least got to a point where this is not part of the game.
It's funny. I can see how this system here is appealing to our neurospicy brains,
yes.
that is present in gaming, certainly, but not just neurospicy, but a specific flavor of neurospicy, because it's exactly like this that, like, you know, those a little more on the autism side are like, oh, this is great, this is meaty, this is chunky, I can do something. And those maybe on the ADHD side are starting to drift and going like, wait, what's happening? What am I supposed to do? What die should I roll?
when I initially look at this page that's in front of us, I get excited. My heart initially flips like, oh, I got it. Oh, this is how it's going to work. I want to see the details. If I was like 10 years old when I got into this, I would totally have tried to use this. And then I start thinking about, do I really want to count units of 3/4 of an inch on the table when I'm moving the miniatures around? And it's going to be like, okay, I guess I don't want to do that. Now, interestingly, you know, Arneson still wanted to do the same kind of thing with his aerial rules. And this year, when I was a referee in the Legends of Role-Playing tournament at GaryCon, they still had a little line in their rules of like, you should adjudicate the movement segment by segment. And I was like, really? Really? Amazing. So some people still think that's the solution.
I love the reactions we're getting to this in the chat right now. I love you guys. I love all our viewers. And you know, I hear the excitement in your voice as you describe this, as you dug into this page when we first pulled it up. I hear the excitement. I appreciate you. I love you. And I tried so hard to concentrate and listen to what you are saying. And my brain was just like, nope. Refuse to take any of this content in. No, thank you.
Freaking amazing. Amazing.
Literally, I sat there daydreaming about, wouldn't it be horribly dramatic if while Dan was saying this, I opened to my page of that in my book and just ripped it right out.
Don't make your book ragged. Don't make your book ragged. Oh my God.
Stand up on your table.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Wow. It's not a good idea.
we need to call this. Any final thoughts on Eldritch Wizardry Supplement 3 of OD&D?
I think it's an interesting design experiment. I'm glad it's in the world. There's a lot amazing. Signed, no less. You know, you get these named characters that we recognize today that are enormously influential in D&D. I mean, if nothing
absolutely
else,
not
the
a
idea
real
of naming people.
This is somebody did evidence point. Of where I obtained these PDFs from, which I probably shouldn't talk about.
And I think it's interesting to, as an experiment, to see what the boundaries of original D&D are. I mean, you mentioned before we get started here that it kind of has a flavor of fourth edition to you. I absolutely feel the same way. Of it, if it's useful to, when we transgress what D&D really, how D&D really works, that's interesting. It's an interesting guideline to keep in mind. Not to like what gets too complicated and what gets too much. So I think that's actually some useful lessons in there to keep in mind as we add stuff. Not everything has to be on the players, right? There can be some weird broken stuff on the DMs that you don't have to give everything to the players, which was again a habit that they were in that was I think that they regretted later on.
Yep. Yeah. I'm trying hard to find the value. I agree with some of the ideas are interesting. Some of the things they were reacting to are interesting to think about. I'm not glad it exists. I regret every second I wasted reading this.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Wow. That's spicy take. Holy cow. Wow.
Not
okay. I'm glad I heard that.
Not for me at all. Not for me, I'm afraid.
Okay. There's a good chance there's going to be an adventure at HelgaCon that uses a lot of stuff out of Eldritch Wizardry.
Oh, good God. Well, enjoy that, Dan. Tell me all about it.
After. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Viewers, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about Supplement 3? You have thoughts? Do you align with Dan? Do you align with me? Are you somewhere in between? It's a pretty big gulf. Leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. And I hope it does not promote any further.
Amazing. Wow. Amazing. I can't wait to see the shorts from this. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, and GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and exegete that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us right now on one of those sites, and it gives the ability to do so, please consider giving us a 5-star review. That helps other users of that site find us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, and big thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, where our brilliant, charismatic, lovely, diplomatic, supportive patrons are conversing about these issues and more 24/7 all the time. We get some great ideas for shows, and we get some great ideas, some great solutions for our games. So we would love for you to appear there and join that conversation. And again, in about 10 minutes, we'll be back there for our live video after chat to continue this conversation. I know I have more to say. I think Paul has some more to say, and probably there's some other takes from our very, very wise patrons that I want to hear today as well. So we'll be there in about 10 minutes. And don't forget that we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.